YouTube clips or SportsCenter highlights that are just absolutely geeking out. You know, under, you know, painting my own face, I'm the biggest United States national team fan that there probably is. You know, I got my first taste of the World Cup really back in 1994 when the U.S. hosted the World Cup, and I got to go to a quarterfinal game, Brazil against Holland, in the Cotton Bowl back in Dallas, where it was about 121 degrees in the middle of the summer. But every time the World Cup rolls around, it's you know, one of the greatest thrills to be able to watch the games. I would have loved to have been able to participate in just one. You know, obviously Pablo got to play in two, but I think Pablo said the same thing. We really are, even though soccer is our profession, it's what we do for a job. We love doing it, and the World Cup is just completely different from anything else that I experienced watching on TV live, and just getting caught up in the emotions and the camaraderie, and I really can't wait for it to kick off.
You know, I think for myself, it's along the same lines as Drew. For me, 86 years was the first World Cup that I'd actually been able to watch, and I think it was then when a guy by the name of Diego Maradona took the world by storm, and I remember it was just, it inspired me to be a soccer player, and it was funny because in 2002, I remember stepping out on the field against Portugal, and after the game, there was some random banner there, and it was my family that made this huge banner and said, "Dare to dream, we love you, Pablo," and it just took me back to sitting on the couch with my old man in 86, watching him kick furniture around when Argentina was playing, and just really inspired the whole family to get together, and barbecues, and the neighbors, and the neighborhood, and everyone was so dialed in. And, you know, up until I think this last World Cup, I really enjoyed watching the World Cup as a fan, and watching the players and what they individually bring to a collective group. And now, as a coach, I think it's going to be interesting for me to look at it from a more tactical perspective, all the while enjoy the festivities and the teams, and their different styles of play. But definitely enjoy it from a different perspective. But all the while, it's about fun, enjoyment, and bringing everyone together.
Dan, you wrote today about how Pablo is actually off to the second best start of any Rapids head coach. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and follow up at all? Just, yeah, you can grab that
one. So I just kind of took a look back at all the previous head coaches and kind of tallied up wins and losses and draws through the first 15 matches. And Pablo's second best record so far, and second only to Gary Smith. And, you know, so far we've seen a very unique strategy, at least from MLS perspective, of rotating in a lot of players. And so he's been getting his entire roster involved. And so Pablo and maybe Drew, just kind of wondering, how do you think that philosophy has built the team, and going forward, Do you plan to, at some point, I mean, I know you've mentioned that you don't really pay attention to the results, at least at this point. Is there going to come a time during the season where you start to look at the standings and say, you know, kind of zero in on it a little bit more?
Well, I think to answer your question just from the start, I think as a coach, and this is something that I've been thinking about for many years and really enjoy, you know, talking life with everyone, and how sport at times transcends life. And so everything I do from a coaching perspective is an extension of who I am. So I don't know how to be anyone else. I don't know how to coach like anyone else. I don't know how to live my life like anyone else. So everything I do is from a feeling, and it comes from a place of my life experiences. So when I was asked to take over the gig, I didn't think about necessarily the best things that other coaches did, or the worst things that coaches did. My whole concept of coming into this was to be true to who I am. And at the end of the day, whether it works or it doesn't work, I sleep easy. Because it's not following someone else's footsteps. It's not following someone else's path. My whole thing and vision is if we want to do something different, if we want to be, and I tell these guys, and it sounds crazy to everyone, I tell them, I want to be the best team in the world. I don't want to be the best team in the world. You can't think like other coaches and be that team. You got to think outside the box. And me being who I am, I've always lived my life outside the box. I've never followed any kind of guidelines or rules. The way I think is different. So this coaching opportunity is an extension of who I am. So talking about not having starters, I challenge these guys every day to come to work prepared to win their job. If you come, you've been to a few practices. These guys compete every practice. There's a high level of intensity, focus, concentration. I also ask them to think of the game like no one's ever asked them to think of the game. And so instilling this philosophy, of course, it's going to take some time. And if I look at the results, how do I explain to someone and tell somebody to go win a game? There's got to be a process to be had in order to achieve what you want to achieve, individually and collectively. It's easy to say, I want to win this game. Well, yeah, we all want to win this game. How are we going to do that? I want to win this war. Yeah, let's go out and win this war, but how are we going to do that? What are the steps that we're going to take individually, the roles that we have, and how does that fit in the grand scheme of our philosophy as a team? So these things aren't just like, I'm not just throwing random players out there and saying, guys, win this game. I know that it's a process and it takes a year. I'm willing to take that and work on that because I know once it catches and you have 11 guys on the field and then you have 18 guys not on the field at that particular time that all believe and all feel like they've been treated equally and all feel like they've been given an opportunity to show their best, I think that's when you have a team. And everyone talks about healthy competition, but who's willing to give the players those opportunities to have healthy competition? It's easy for a coach to say, stick with these 11, come hell or high water. Because you know what it does? It kind of keeps the other guys at bay so I don't have to explain things to them. But Drew will attest to this. I have conversations with 30 players. Every week I'm having conversations with players. Let them know where they stand. This is the idea moving forward. Well, you know, they come into my office. But Pablo, listen, what do I have to do to get on the 18? And I say the same things to all the guys. You're asking the wrong question. It's not about the 18. And it's not about the 11. How do you become a better soccer player? The 18 and the 11 will take care of themselves. So this whole, it's a paradigm shift of the way I view the world, the way I view team. And you know, I'll let Drew speak from his perspective. I don't know if it's working. But I don't know any other way. So I can't change because if I change, I'm not being honest with myself. And that's something that I can't live with.
We'll just respond to that, and then John Meyer has a question.
Yeah, and Pablo, it's definitely working, and I know that because there's a group of 28, 29, 30 guys, however many it is, I don't even know how many it is these days, are walking into that locker room every single day. You know, they don't take a day off mentally, they don't take a day off physically when they walk into that locker room, and they think, what can I do to get on the field? I need to go put my best foot forward today to get myself on the field. And I know this because I see it. And as the captain of this team and a leader of this team and a guy who's been here for a while and a guy that wants to win championships for this team, what more can you ask of from your coach that brings the absolute best out of an entire squad of players? When he announces the starting 11, every single player is looking up there to see if their name's on it. There's nobody that can look down and know, I'm gonna be in the starting 11. And when you have that kind of competition day in and day out, which translates on the training field, which then will translate on Saturday night, you can't ask for more from your coach. And it's been great so far. Just from a soccer, yeah, it's probably the happiest I've been in my 10 years as a professional. And it's certainly the most competitive squad that I've probably been around in 10 years as well. So it's definitely working right now, and we just hope to keep it rolling.
John Meyer?
First, about an observation, and I'll try to figure out a question that goes with it. But I think you just saw an example of what I've seen over the past couple months in the way Pablo conducts his business. If you all are Raptors fans, you obviously watched him play for many years. He was such an emotional player. He was such a passionate player. He was thoughtful, but he was running pretty hot. And I have been really blown away interacting with him after games and in practices, and really struck with how thoughtful he is. He's really deeply thoughtful. Almost any question that comes up, he gives his philosophy, and you know that he spent a lot of time thinking about this. And it's almost like a clinic. It's almost like a little seminar every time we have a conversation, because he's thought through these things. You know, he thinks outside the box, but it's not impulsive. It's very, very well thought through. And I guess my question would be to Drew, if you, being his teammate, you must have known that he was this thoughtful, because you were seeing him when he wasn't running white hot after a game. And my question to Pablo, first of all, would be, how these things that you've thought about, obviously you haven't been thinking about just for the last 2 months or 6 months, you've been thinking about for what, your whole playing career, I suppose. And I think you've said that you saw coaches do things that you didn't like as a player, and it made you think about how you would be if you were a coach. So could you talk a little bit about how you formed this philosophy? And it wasn't knee-jerk, it wasn't impulsive, it was very well thought through. And then maybe Drew, if you could talk about what you saw in him as a player as this was all percolating.
Yeah, well, I'll just start. You know, Pablo, to me, is the same person as a coach as he was as a player. You know, you and I have had conversations before, and one thing I always say about Pablo is he's always thinking. He was always thinking as a player. He was always communicating with the entire group, whether it's on the field or off the field, because he wants to get on the same page with you, you know, especially on the field. If he knows what I'm going to do and I know what he's going to do, who's going to get by us? Who's going to be able to stop us, you know? And I've seen a lot of coaches who I feel like are different as a coach than they were as a player. And, you know, a lot of times I think, you know, like you said, a coach says, well, I didn't like when a coach did this, so I'm not going to do that. I feel like Pablo actually does that. He remembers what he didn't like as, you know, other coaches doing, and so he's not going to do that. And he's going to do what he liked as a player. And, you know, fortunately for me and probably every other player on the team, a lot of guys like what Pablo likes, you know? And he's still the same, passionate, wants to win absolutely everything. But again, always thinking, you know, how can I make this team better? How can we break down this team? And I think one thing that has stood out to me from Pablo's perspective as a coach is we'll watch video on another team, but we're not watching video because we have to see how they play and we're going to change the way we play because of how they play. We, you know, we watch video just to get kind of a refresher of what they do and who some of their players are, but we want to go out and dictate the play. You know, we want to have them adapt to us, have them have to change to us. And, you know, when Pablo was on the field, he didn't want to have to change the way he played because of other players. And it's the same with the team, and that's really refreshing, because I don't feel like a lot of coaches are like that.
I think everything kind of stemmed from, like you said, John, the way I felt as a player and the way coaches made me feel. And I think that I'm a real sensitive soul, so to speak. Sometimes there's a bunch of facade that kind of obscures that. But I remember coming to the league and I had some coaches that were very demeaning, very belittling, aggressive. And I think I kept saying to myself, it doesn't matter what you do for a living. You just want to be treated with respect. And from that stemmed this concept of treating every human being like you want to be treated. And the coaches that I really enjoyed weren't necessarily the best coaches, but it was the human element that I really enjoyed. And I thought, man, I became a better player but I didn't really learn a whole lot about the game. So now it's like, so for me, it's I really know what I want from the team tactically. I drill it technically. But it's the human element, I think, that transcends. And you talk about in sport, this chemistry, oh, team chemistry. Well, what is it? And so that's been my focus, is how do you develop this team that believes in each other, believes in themselves, believes in the group, believes in the direction we're going in, treat them with respect. And, you know, that's not to say, I have very tough decisions to make. I have to explain to some guys that have been MLS All-Stars for years and say, listen, today, or this week, my idea is this. What do you think about that? And they'll say, yeah, I'm a bit disappointed, but I understand where you're going with that. And then I say, well, you seem to be ready to come in and contribute, because if called upon, we're going to need you to win this game. And so what I've realized as a human being first, and then as a coach, if you just tell it straight, it will hurt initially because we all have egos. But the ego will understand at some point. And then there will be a level of respect that has been gained because you told me to my face, and you didn't hide behind this veil of secrecy, or I don't know if I should tell him. I'll just wait. I'll just put up the starting 11 the day before the game and surprise everyone. So for me, it's treat people like I've always wanted to be treated as a player. There's with Bruce Arena, the national team, I spent more time on the bench for that coach than on the field over the years. In my last 6 months in LA, and that's still the one coach I've run through a wall for. So that speaks a lot to me about what it takes to lead a team from a coaching perspective. Yeah, it's important you know this stuff, and we drill it, like I said, and that's critical. How do you motivate these guys? Find a way to get them to motivate themselves intrinsically, as well as you light a fire every now and again. But most importantly is, how do you build an environment that is rich with competition and one that allows these guys to flourish in their own individual way.
I just want to say that, thank you, Pablo. There is food in the back. Linda, is that correct? Yes? Okay. So if you're all hungry, no cost, food in the back. Mark Kisler, you had a question.
Yeah, I want to turn it to the World Cup, but I'm going to do it by jumping off of an idea that Pablo threw out there. You said you want the Rapids to feel think like the best club in the world because you know no other way. How well do you think the U.S. national team has established that mentality of thinking like the best national team in the world? And what are the keys that you see to them surviving this gauntlet of Ghana, Portugal, and Germany to advance to the knockout round?
It's interesting. It was brought to my attention that Jurgen Klinsmann had said that the U.S. has no chance to win the World Cup. And that's coming from a completely different mindset and that reverse psychology. I don't know a lot about psychology, but it's that, I think he was motivating the players by saying they had no chance.
But that's hard to believe that you believe you're the best. Your coaches tell you have no chance.
That's where I come from. And that's why I never say anything like that. But then again, I've said it before, having played for the U.S. team in 2002, we were in a tough group. We had the hosts, Portugal and Poland. And I think the United States is still in a stage of development in international soccer where we feel more comfortable as a country playing the underdog role as opposed to being the team that's supposed to show and play a great brand over and over and over again. I think we're getting closer. I think you have the Dempseys, the Altidores, the Bradleys, Tim Howard, and on. And I think we're building something special with this group. Having said that, I think we have a good chance if we can get a couple results. This group, it's a tournament, so it's not like you're playing each team 10 times, because if we had to do that, I don't think we'd fare well. But in a tournament style, I think the underdog role, you get one win, you get a good draw in the first game, you move to the next one, you get a draw and win, and all of a sudden, it's that believing that you can actually achieve these things that you set out for yourself. So I think, I can sit here and guess and say, but my gut feeling is this, is that the U.S. is going to get out of the group, and then they will be a team to be reckoned with moving the tournament.
The idea I hear so many fans say it was a bad draw, it's a group of death. But I agree with you that the U.S. plays better when it embraces the underdog role. And this group allowed him to say, we're the underdog, so we'll meet Portugal in the jungle and we'll see what happens.
No, you're spot on. I agree 100%. And like I said, these guys, the history with Ghana, Portugal, those guys have to come out and make the game, because the whole world, the international soccer community, is looking at them like they've already beat the United States. And so now the onus is on them to come out and make the game, and I think we'll be at our best coming out from the dark.
I want to just thank you. I just want to open it up that if any of you have questions, you can just come up here and I can give you the microphone right now to ask them. So do I have any takers for audience questions for any of our three great reps out there?
It's a Rapids question, but I feel like Graham Zuzi destroyed our boy Gabby Torres. What are we going to do to get that guy back? Is he with the team right now, or what's he doing? It seems like ever since Mexico, or since Zuzi hit that goal, they allowed Mexico to advance. He hasn't been the same.
Yeah, no, I think it's there's a whole multitude of things. And I think, Gabby's at the moment in a transitional moment in his career, both physically and in form. And now it's about integrating him back into the team, coming off of a 3-week program, and that we hope to continue incorporating as the season goes. The striker position, it's so touchy. If you score a goal, you're on top of the world. If you don't score a goal, you lose confidence. And Deshaun Brown had that at the beginning of the year. And now he's starting to find his form, and he's starting to find the back of the net. And now he's just, his presence is you can feel his energy is different. And that's what it's going to take for Gabby. So we're excited to get Gabby back and put him in. We have a couple games here in the Open Cup, a game against Vancouver coming up. We're going to need our full roster, and just looking forward to getting him back in form and hopefully finding the back of the net earlier than not, and just getting the Gabby that we know back.
I actually have a question. I just want all of your takes. I think the biggest news so far, besides the World Cup's draw, is Landon Donovan, the all-time leading scorer for the United States, is not going to be on the World Cup roster. And I just, given his history and given his talent, I just want all of you to sort of reflect on that. Is this sort of a changing of the guard? And what do you think that means for this U.S. team going into this? I'll start with John.
Well, I was actually going to ask Pablo that, because it's not a question he would want to answer, I don't think. Second-guessing another coach's calculated risk. He's going to get second guessed on this big time to put a player on, to put Julian Green on the team when Julian Green never played for the U.S. until April 2nd. If you're here, you probably know, but he's a kid that was born in Tampa, moved to Germany when he was 2 years old, came up through the Bayern Munich system, plays for their second team in a fourth division league or whatever, had a chance to play for Germany in the future or U.S. now. He picked U.S. now. So, yeah, Jurgen Klinsmann really put himself on the line for that. You know, how well Julian Green plays at this World Cup, in the subsequent World Cups, will maybe tell the tale on that. The other thing that Marcelo Balboa pointed out in speculating about this, maybe Jurgen didn't like it too much when Landon decided to take a sabbatical in the middle of World Cup qualifying. And, we heard these two guys talk about the chemistry within a locker room. I think we can wonder what kind of atmosphere and chemistry there might have been around Landon Donovan in that locker room. We don't know, we're not there. But Jurgen Klinsmann obviously decided he was better off without him. So we'll see. It's certainly what everybody's going to be talking about. But I will turn to you. Do you want to second guess that decision, or how do you feel about it? The Land of Diamonds?
I've been so back and forth between the Landon Donovan thing. I don't understand the decision. Jurgen Klinsmann's a smart guy, and I think what a lot of people don't realize is he's not just the head coach of the U.S. national team. He's kind of the technical director of U.S. soccer, and you know, one of the first things I believe he said when he took over this role was he's going to kind of change the face of the way U.S. soccer is played, whether, you know, it's the national team or the youth national teams. And so, you know, his job isn't just to pick, you know, the traditionally, you know, face of U.S. soccer from the past, you know, 12, 13, 15 years. His job is to put this, you know, national team in a position to compete to win World Cups. And, you know, we've already heard his quote saying he doesn't think that this is a World Cup that we can win, you know, whether that is reverse psychology or not. But he's made some interesting decisions already. He's, you know, he's going to the, you know, far corners of the world to find the best players that maybe other national team coaches didn't even know could play for the U.S. national team. He's almost recruited in, you know, like a Julian Green, like you said. And I almost feel bad for Julian Green in this, because here's this 18-year-old that's been selected to play for the national team in the World Cup, and all people are saying is, oh, he's there instead of Landon Donovan, and it's almost like people don't like him because of it. And so I'm a huge Landon Donovan fan. You know, we played him a month ago, and I said this to you, he still strikes fear in me, and I guarantee you he still strikes fear in every other defender that is at this World Cup that doesn't have to worry about him now. And so disappointed not to see him there, but don't, you know, I don't think we should judge Jurgen Klinsmann's roster until after the World Cup. And, you know, whether he set himself up to be in some hot water if they don't do well because of the Landon Donovan choice, I'm sure he'll handle that just fine. But, you know, don't judge the man until we see what's happened.
Mark? The best comment I heard about Klinsmann leaving off Donovan was snarky, but I think it got right to the point. Donovan would have had a much better chance to make the team if his mother had been German. So I think this decision represents the best of what I see in Klinsmann and also the worst of what I see in Klinsmann. The best is, and Pablo said this, in his group of 30 guys, he wants you to be the best player you can be. Don't worry about the 18 or don't worry about the 11. Worry about how good you are today and how much better you're going to be tomorrow. So Klinsmann makes this decision without respect to rank or tradition or resume. I think that's great. I also think that in the U.S. soccer, you have a German coaching the U.S. national team, and he dunked the most decorated player in U.S. history. It better work, because if it doesn't, he's going to be pointed to, fair or not, just the way the world works, as a German who dunked on an American. And let's see how that works out for him, building for 2018, if heaven forbid they lose two and draw one, or they get swept in this pool play. But I took the hard edge. You can say whatever you want.
It's easy. It's not easy, but those are tough decisions to be made. And being a coach, again, if you live in this head, you'd go crazy. You know, I don't know what he's thinking. I don't know the thoughts behind it. I only know what I see and what I've experienced, and that's that Landon's a world-class athlete. He's still, for me, top two or three best Americans in the world. He's one of the classiest people you will meet off the field, and he has this urge to really share his experiences with the younger guys and pull people aside and explain to them, which for a young team like we have at the World Cup, I think would make a lot of sense. But again, it's easy for me, and those are my experiences.
This is what I'd like to know from you. If Jurgen decided not to start and he was a player they looked at as we'll get a spark in the 60th minute, how do you think Landon would have responded to that role? I know it's speculation, but you know him pretty well.
Landon would love to be in that situation. And like I said, he likes that mentor role, and he pulls people aside. You know, when I was playing with him, you know, I got to play with him for the last 6 months of my career and was training with him on a day-to-day basis. And there was ample times we pulled the young guys aside and say, listen, when you're in this position, you got to use the inside of your foot. Don't just laser the ball. You got to the goalie's going to more than likely dive here. And so he'd take time to work with these guys. And I think, you know, what he represents to not only U.S. soccer, but the international game today still holds a lot of value. So it was an interesting decision and one that doesn't make sense to me. But I also don't know every detail that went behind the decision making. So if you're judging it on other parameters that I'm not privy to, then it might make sense.
Dan Bonifins, do you have anything to add?
I'd say that pretty much covers it, but it's hard for me to believe that coming off the bench, he couldn't contribute at least something positive. And you look at his history, scoring probably the biggest goal in U.S. history against Algeria, and even just look at what he did coming off being cut from the team, comes back to MLS and scores two goals. So he's just a big-time player, and it seems like, you know, when the clutch moment comes, he's going to be there for it.
And we've got an audience question from Mr. Nick Crook.
And I hope this isn't too specific. I think we're all keeping up okay. And I know, Coach, that you have to be discreet in your job, but I'm curious what, if you don't mind, just even an objective scouting report, what does DeAndre Yedlin offer the national team that Chris Klute or Shane O'Neill doesn't or couldn't? And also, you can be political if you want, but and then if you want to keep going, what does Chris Wondolowski offer that Landon Donovan doesn't? I don't know if that's the one-to-one comparison that's appropriate or not. But.
Well, I think first off, when you build a group of 23, you take in so many different variables. It's not just the performance on the field. And a good example of this is when I got my call in 2002, I'll never forget, I was driving down 120th on my way to a golf event, and the phone rang, and it was Bruce, and he said, "I'm going to bring you to the World Cup." And I was like, what? I had to pull over. I couldn't believe it. You know, I was, didn't play in a qualifier. You know, I still felt like unworthy, like, wow, this is amazing. And he says, "Do you know why I'm bringing you?" And I said, "Yeah, I played great in those the friendly against Jamaica. I played great in the Gold Cup, which was a game. I think four games that I participated in. That was I think I had six caps going into the World Cup." And he said, "No." He said, "Let me just explain to you what your role is on this team in 23." He says, "You bust your tail in training every day. You get on break with all the guys. And I know if given an opportunity, you can step up and be big in this moment. But don't forget, you're here because you bust your tail in training every day and you get on good with all the guys." Right. So that to me is when you're building a team, it's not just about your performance on the field. It's how are you if you're not performing on the field? How are you going to be in the locker room, in and amongst the guys, in a foreign land for X amount of days? Are you going to sulk? Are you going to pull some people with you and sulk and destroy the team? So when you ask me about DeAndre Yedlin, I don't know him. I don't know him. I know very little just on the field from when I watch games. I don't know that he can do more than Shane O'Neill or Chris Klute. But I don't have to make that decision either. And then with the Wando thing, I think he scores goals, and that's why he's there. You know, and I think people that find those, you know, Gary Lineker was an English guy that just scored goals inside the six or seven. He was just always in the right spot. And I think of all the forwards on the U.S. team at the moment, I think Chris Wondolowski is the most goal dangerous as far as being in the right spot at the right time. So he's another guy. I'm sure Drew could attest to that as far as having to mark him. And I'll let you
I mean, yeah, Wando is one of those guys. Doesn't do, you know, a lot of things particularly well that you would expect maybe from, you know, probably one of, if not the best striker in Major League Soccer right now, or certainly the past three or four seasons now. But the guy scores goals, and he's scored a lot of goals when I've been on the field. And if I knew what he did well or why he, you know, scored a lot of goals and I could put a finger on it, he wouldn't score as many times when I'm on the field. And I bet most of the other defenders in this league will say that. And, you know, again, I don't know if Wondolowski is the reason Donovan's not there. But when he's on the field, you know, he's now proven it with the national team. He's a threat to score goals.
And what a great opportunity for a guy. You know, I'm good buds with Wando. He's a great guy. You know, couldn't happen to a better guy. And hopefully he goes in, you know, does score for the U.S. and you know, makes his mark.
What about
Yedlin? Again, I don't know DeAndre Yedlin well. I think he's a great young talent. I think Chris Klute and Shane O'Neill are great young talents. Playing with them every single day gives me certainly a different perspective of them than I have of DeAndre Yedlin. I think you can probably substitute any three of those guys and put them on the national team and take them to this World Cup. And, you know, you would have a very reliable defender for sure. And I think Chris Klute and Shane O'Neill will be in World Cups in the very near future. And, you know, hopefully this one in Russia in 2018, if they continue to love it and want it and have that drive to succeed and to get to the World Cups, they certainly have the talent, because I think they could be there for this one if you know, things were a little different.
Another audience question?
Yeah, I'm going to have a question, World Cup question for Pablo and Drew, but before I say that, you're mentioning 2002. I just had the opportunity to rewatch the Mexico game. I know why you were on that team. You were a monster. Absolute monster. The World Cup question I have, you're talking about chemistry. We've talked about it a couple times. When it comes to international matches, sometimes chemistry can be an issue compared to club matches. So those of us who haven't played professional soccer or coached it, when you watch any random World Cup international game, whether it be Germany, Portugal, or, I don't know, Cameroon, Croatia, first 5, 10, 15 minutes, what are you watching for? What's a big key of how you think the game's going to go from the first few minutes of the game?
Well, it's obviously, you're looking to see, like, what team is willing to play in tough, tight areas, and that immediately will put the other team on their heels. So what I preach to our guys here is don't be scared of playing tight spaces early. Because psychologically, the other team already says, wow, these guys aren't scared to play in these kind of tight spots. So the team that has control of the game in the first 5 minutes with possession, I think is an indication of whose mentality is stronger and whose will to impose themselves on the other team is visible. Having said that, I've been a part of many games where you're on top of them for 5 minutes and the one ball goes over the top and it's a counterattack, breakaway goal, and then it's all laid to rest. So unless you can capitalize on those moments of momentum, having the ball and having momentum is useless. It's a team that capitalizes first. And we talk about it all the time with our group. Goals change games. It doesn't matter how well you're doing or, you know, like at the weekend, you know, we had a deflection goal and then another deflection goal, and all of a sudden we're going into halftime 2-1, and we're thinking, how did this happen? I say the same thing all the time. The game of soccer doesn't owe you anything. So it's not the first couple minutes of the game. It's what you do over 90 minutes and those critical moments in the game that really make the outcome.
Yeah, and Pablo, obviously, in terms of the international game, can, you know, speak better about that. But, he kind of pointed out, soccer can be such a funny game sometimes. Especially on such a big stage as the World Cup. There's very few groups in this World Cup, I feel like, that you can say, yeah, those two teams are going to advance, you know? But like Pablo said, you could be on top of a team for 93 minutes and not score a goal, be unlucky, feel confident, everything's going your way, you're going to get that winner late, and a counterattack, you know, bad mistake in the back, loss of concentration, and it's a completely different game. And on the score sheet, you're like, how did that happen? But I always think the start of the game is extremely important because you can set the tone and impose your will and let the other team know this is going to be us today. You're in for a long game. And, I think one thing that Pablo usually says before a game, after he goes through all of his tactical stuff and a little bit of scouting on the other team, is none of that stuff matters because you have to go out there, 11 men, and do whatever you can to get the result. And so, you know, you can talk about the start of the game, you can talk about who possesses the ball more, who's better on set pieces. At the end of the day, It's 11 guys going out and getting the job done. And, you know, to do it on the World Cup stage is the best place to see it, especially in the later rounds.
Eric Gorski?
Thanks, Pablo Madrid. I wanted to ask you about kind of the state of the U.S. fan base. It used to be that the stories were about no one cared. Not enough people followed the game, either the national team or the domestic league. Now I've seen some stories in the last week that are ridiculing the fan base now. They're saying that they're either copying European fans, either with TIFO or with scarves, and we're not original, we're just following. And then I've seen stories also about people taking issue with kind of soccer snobbery that you see among U.S. fans, that they're only going to the pub on Saturday morning at 7 to watch the Premier League, and they're dismissing the MLS. Even more so now than 4 years ago, when you could argue the quality has increased. I was hoping you could talk a little bit about, you know, what you see there and what you think, where things might be headed in this country in terms of getting those fans that are watching the World Cup to watch MLS too.
Well, I'll just start. I think the fact that we have fans that copy is a huge step in the right direction. I think that is the more important part of this whole argument. You know, soccer's been a tradition in most countries for hundreds of years, and we are a country of immigrants at some point, at some stage, in some generation. And so scarves have always been a big part of it, TIFOs, confetti, those ridiculous horns. So there's only so much you can do. I mean, you can't, I don't know. I'm sure we've thought about all the different ways to support our teams. But I think the most important part is that we're supporting teams. And whether other countries say we're copying, it's irrelevant. I think the important part is the game has grown in this country. People are coming out. And for the people that are snobs, it's only a matter of time before this league, and I said it probably 10 years ago, and I was probably a little premature on this, but I think this will be the best league in the world at some point. And I say that because of resources. I say that because everyone you talk about all over the world, their desire to come play in the United States of America is overwhelming. The state of the European Union, Latin America, economically, this place is just rife with growth, and you know, so I think it's a matter of time before these snobs will then say, well, there's no Premier League worth watching anymore because all the best players in the world are now a part of this domestic league.
John Meyer?
I want to add a little historical perspective here on that. I hearken back to, again, there's not too many old folks here like me tonight, but I remember watching the 1978 World Cup when I was covering this team in Tampa Bay. And in order to watch, all you got to see was the World Cup final. And you had to go to a movie theater and watch it on closed-circuit TV. I could still close my eyes and remember the auditorium when Argentina won that tournament and all the confetti falling in the stadium. And that's where we were in 1978. You know, thinking, but kids were starting to play, especially in the Tampa Bay area and the Dallas area, even then. And I remember thinking, man, these kids are coming out to go into North American Soccer League games. If they can just get old enough where they get the keys to mom and dad's car so they can take kids on dates, girls or boys on dates, to go to the games, soccer's going to make it. Well, it took a lot longer than that. But every year, every World Cup, you see more and more interest. And I will never forget watching World Cup with my daughter 4 years ago and being in a bar in Lodo, shoulder to shoulder with people, equally men and women. And now we're in a place where there's these millions of women who played soccer as little girls. You know, I covered the gold medal final in women's gold medal final in Athens in 2004 with Brandi Chastain in that group. And I literally cried at the end of that game because I thought of the impact that those women had on my daughter and girls like her. But watching World Cup here, the Algeria game, in fact, and I'm realizing this place is full of men and women. And they know the game so well enough that they know the fine points of the game. They see the ball go out and they realize it's going to be a corner kick and not a throw, and they're excited because they know goals come on corner kicks, but not throw-ins from the touchline. And I remember thinking, they can't take us for granted anymore as soccer fans. This sport has arrived. It'll be a while before it's filling stadiums like the NFL, but this country now has millions of true soccer fans who know the game, who love it, and we're not going back to the old days. This is just going to get better and better and better. And after watching the World Cup 4 years ago and 8 years ago, I can't wait to see what this World Cup is like.
Well, do you have something to add?
I've covered the women's gold medal match in London, and I will say that the biggest U.S. cheer I heard at the Summer Olympics in London was they had a great Olympic Park and a giant screen TV in it. And I did not go to Manchester to see U.S. play Canada, but so I watched the game on that giant screen, and it was like, this is the USA, and we're here, and we just beat Canada. And that was the USA moment. And that's a soccer country. And is it the soccer country that Brazil is? Heck no. But it's a lot closer than it was 30 years ago.
All right, well, we are almost out of time here. So I'm going to ask just one last question for each one of you. World Cup related, who gets out of Group G, and then who wins the whole thing? I'll give you a few minutes to think about it. And are there... Oops. All right. John Meyer, you were on the hot seat.
If you had asked me a week ago, I would have said Portugal and Germany. But I'm starting to think, I'm persuaded by the fact that it's going to be so hot, so humid, and what the U.S. may lack in tactics and technical ability, if it goes up against Germany, for example, the U.S. probably will be the fittest team there, or among the fittest teams there, and it may be the playing Germany 4 days after they play Portugal. I think it's 4 days. You talked the other day about how it was borderline criminal to make MLS players play on a Sunday and then play on a Wednesday, and those are both home games. Now we're talking about playing Portugal and Germany. I don't recall. I assume they're in different stadiums, so there'll be travel involved. Dealing with tropical heat and humidity, that's tough, but you know, I'm going to assume that the U.S. is going to be better under heat and humidity. So I'm not saying they'll beat Germany, but maybe they'll get a result there and advance with Germany.
Overall.
I'm not going to be very creative here. I'm going to say Brazil, you know, give them the home country advantage. They do have a lot of pressure, though, because they can't just win. They have to be entertaining, or their fans are not going to like it, correct? They have to win with style. It's not enough just to win. So they're going to have a lot of pressure, but as Marcelo said the other day, the Brazilians, they love pressure.
All right. I'm known as a contrarian. Brazil will not win. And part of the reason I say this is... Our Winter Olympic experience. The one thing Russia wanted to do in Russia was win the men's gold hockey medal. And the pressure of that was unbelievable, and they didn't do it. I don't think Brazil will flop like the Russian hockey team did, but I would suspect that Argentina or Uruguay wins out of South America before Brazil does. The U.S., group of death. First of all, it ain't the death. There's two groups out there that are just as tough, or nearly as tough. So I believe this. I believe, like I said before, the underdog role fits the U.S. well. The United States beats Ghana, they'll advance. If they lose to Ghana, it's over. They can come home. But I do believe if they beat Ghana, they will advance. They'll beat Portugal in the jungle. And it's going to be 107 degrees or at least 92% humidity, but they have to be done to do that. I'll take Germany, though.
I just did something earlier and I said, Brazil was going to win it. But I like the Argentina shout. Either one of those two. And out of our group, I'd say the U.S. and Germany. And then the dark horse is, who's in an incredibly tough group. I'm going to say dark horse would be Chile. Drew.
Yeah, I've tried not to analyze it too much. I say Germany and U.S. advance from Group G, and I will take Argentina to win it all. Thank you.
And Dan Boniface.
Being from America, my heart would be with the U.S. U.S. and Germany, I think, makes the most sense out of Group G. But again, you look at what Ghana just did to South Korea, 4-0 today. Ghana looks good. I think they could be a dark horse in that group. And to win the whole thing, I like Brazil. I mean, they're the host country. They have unfinished business from the last time they hosted. But you look at the other South American teams, they're very familiar with the area, playing in those cities and in qualifying. So I think, Uruguay, Argentina could definitely give them a run as well, but I think Brazil will take it.
All right. Well, let's give a round of applause for our conversation. Thank you so much. And on behalf of the Everpros, we thank you for coming out, and we will see you next time. Thank you.